Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Margaret Atwood and Ursula K. Le Guin. Margaret Atwood is a poet, novelist, short story writer, essayist, and environmental activist. She's written over 40 books and is best known for her fiction, including The Blind Assassin, which won the Man Booker Prize in 2000. Atwood has used her public profile to advocate for human rights, the environment, and the welfare of writers. She has been president of Pen International and helped found the Writers' Trust of Canada. As a public intellectual, Atwood is known as a brilliant thinker on a huge range of subjects and has a wry and ironic sense of humor. Ursula K. Le Guin sold her first story over 50 years ago and has been writing and publishing ever since. Tackling various genres and modes, including realistic fiction, science fiction, high fantasy, children's literature, screenplays, and essays, her work has challenged traditional understandings of gender roles, politics, race, and identity. She is best known for her fantasy series Earthsea and her science fiction novel The Left Hand of Darkness. She has influenced a whole generation of writers. Writers as diverse as Juno Diaz, Kelly Link, David Mitchell, and Jonathan Lethem all claim her as an influence. Summing her long career is virtually impossible, causing one critic to note, "It's been hard for reviewers to cope with Le Guin. She often seemed like a writer without a critical context." But that may just mean the context is still to come. Among her many honors, Le Guin has received 5 Hugo Awards, 5 Nebula Awards, a National Book Award, and the National Book Foundation Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters. Now, from the 2010-2011 season of Portland Arts and Lectures, here is Margaret Atwood and Ursula K. Le Guin speaking in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
I was nervous about tonight, and I'm Germanic by genetically, and so I wanted a little structure. And I warned Margaret about this. I emailed Margaret 6 weeks or so ago and said, "What are we going to talk about?" And she replied, "I expect we will talk about 1, what is fiction? 2, what is science fiction? 3, the ones who walk away from Omelas, where do they go? 4, is the human race doomed? 5, anything else that strikes our fancy?" So I took this as a splendid structure for... So, 1A. What is fiction? Okay, now... Then, you know, I started thinking about what I would like to hear from you.
Tell me about it.
Well, I want to talk about process of writing fiction, maybe, and purpose of writing fiction. In Negotiating with the Dead, lovely book, you talk about how to get a story, the writer has to go into the dark, the underworld, the other world. You said going into a narrative, into the narrative process, is a dark road. You can't see your way ahead. And that resonated very much with me. Absolutely. But critics and readers, do you find, tend to assume that it's all daylight where we go and we know what we're doing?
I think it's because of the way it gets taught. The teacher has the finished text and doesn't have to go through the process of creating it. And it looks a lot as if you knew all along what you were doing.
Yeah, you've brought it back up into the daylight.
Yes, or for instance, a Shakespeare sonnet. We don't get to see the parts he crossed out in the process of writing it. We just get the finished thing, and we think, wow, is that ever perfect? Did he ever know what he was doing? Well, probably not. And how I came to that dark road thing, I started this book about writing. People usually want to know a writer's motives for writing. So I started asking dead writers and living ones, I don't really talk to the dead people. I look in their books just in, just in case anybody out there decides to put on Twitter, Atwood talks to dead people.
It'll be there.
Yes, it'll be there. Well, I look in their books and see, usually, it's usually in the preface or something like that, or in their letters, their motives. And I also talked to living writers about their motives. And the motives were everything. They were everything from to justify the ways of God to man, to impress my high school fellow students and show them up and get back at my parents, make a lot of money, improve mankind, you know. Just, and you can have more than one of these motives at once. You can have to justify the ways of God to man and get back at my parents, but pretty close. So I wasn't going to get anywhere with the motives. I think my favorite one was from a young Czech writer who said that her intention in writing was to create a boudoir for the reader so that the reader could go into the boudoir and have fun. I'm sure that is why you yourself have always written. So I wasn't going to get anywhere that way. So
is that
wonderful? I think it's great. we might say imaginary world, but boudoir.
No, but I like boudoir.
Okay, so then instead I turned to process rather than intention, and that brought up these themes again and again. For instance, Virginia Woolf said that writing a novel was like going into a dark room with a lamp and holding up the lamp, and with the aid of the lamp you could see what was there all along. And other people spoke of, you know, of being in a cave and looking out, or crossing a dark river, or going along a dark road, or
and flashes of light.
Flashes of light. There's always
rather
light
than
in
the lamp.
It. Yes, there's always light.
Flashes.
Flashes of light, or going towards a light, and then when you finally emerge, you can see where you are and where you've been.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I see now. Yeah.
Yes, like that. Now I get it.
Yeah.
It's the boudoir. Now I get it.
may we now leave the boudoir?
Well, okay, but then, you know, they're all the How to Write books tell you about planning and plotting and you know, sort of seeing your book ahead and so on. And I have always felt that, particularly with a novel, with a long project like a novel, I might not know where it was going. No, I did know kind of where it was going. I had a trajectory in mind. That I could, there was something to follow that was a forward-going shape. But how I would get to the end of the trajectory, I did not know. Now, is that how it is with you?
Very similar, except that I may think at the beginning that I know where that trajectory is leading, and then find out that actually it goes to a different place. That the ending that I had thought I was going towards is not the place where I end up. But if I knew, and I'm sure you're the same, that if we knew everything ahead of time, we wouldn't write the book.
It wouldn't be any fun.
Because it would be paint by numbers.
Yeah.
And it would not be any, there wouldn't be any discoveries.
Which is what depresses me about the books that tell you about how you have to have your plot all sort of plotted out.
Well, I think that's good for a certain kind of writing. In fact, if you're writing a Harlequin romance, they more or less tell you what they do.
Well, in a mystery, I guess I'm told you have to write it backwards.
Yes, Edgar Allan Poe said you have to write mysteries backwards because you have to know who'd done it.
Yeah.
So that you can sprinkle the
so you can, so that
false
you can
clues
it. Yeah.
And deceive everybody. And that's the point.
Okay. All right. 1B. We will desert this.
I always kind of knew that it was Bill in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy because of the way his clothing is described. Shall I elucidate?
Yes.
The clothing and the metaphors about him are trickster figure metaphors. He's described in terms of a harlequin. Mm-hmm. So I thought, oh well then, haha, we know. And in fact, that turned out to be right, and I didn't even peek, which I do, I confess. Atwood peeks. Atwood peaks at ends of books sometimes. I do. It drives Graham mad. He actually hates it. He says, you're peeking. And I said, well, I want to know how it turns out to see if I can stand the ending. It's not going to make me too unhappy. Then I can read the rest of the book.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
But it's okay, because if I really like the book, I'll go back to the beginning and read it all over again in the right order.
Oh, well, rereading a book is much better than reading it anyway. A good book reread is better than a good book read. In the third or fourth time is even better, I think.
Well, you pick up things that you missed the first time through.
I'm a very fast, very careless reader, and I miss everything the first time around.
Yes, well, then you ought to. Yes, I even did that when I'm writing them.
We are fast and careless writers, but the second time around, man. Okay, now what about the purpose of fiction? I'm rereading Negotiating with the Dead. You talk about art as, you know, art for art's sake. In other words, art as a craft, as a skill, as its own end, versus the agenda, which is sort of inevitable in narrative, as opposed to most other arts.
You kind of can't help having the reader make a moral interpretation of how the story has
gone. No matter how hard you try.
No matter how hard you try. And the person who tried the very, very hardest of all is Robe Grier, the French writer who did the new wave fiction in which you weren't supposed to have any characters or plot. So it does come out a lot like a cafeteria tray. So there's a lot of descriptions of plates and cutlery and objects, basically.
I tried to read Robe Grier.
This is my point.
Yeah. I tried earnestly, conscientiously. But he's French, he's theoretical. This is not, you know,
it's a what if thing. What would happen if we took out the plot and the characters?
Yeah.
Well, this is what happens, and you have.
Sort of like
trouble reading
it.
It is a lot like certain scientific experiments that you have to ask, why did they do that?
Yeah, so what if we took out the blood from the body, you know?
Well, I can tell you the answer to that. But there was the man who did actually, and this is true, he did feel that if you created a naked chicken, that the energy that... I'm not lying about this.
No.
Do not put on your Twitter Atwood lies about naked chickens. It's actually true. He felt that if you removed the feathers and bred a naked chicken, that the energy that usually went into the feathers, growing, would result in more eggs. But the catch was that, and it did, but the catch was that the chickens got cold and they shivered. And so you had to heat their dwelling place so that they wouldn't shiver and be cold. And the sum of the money caused that you spent heating their dwelling place exceeded the sum that you gained by having them live.
This isn't science, this is capitalism.
You think you can't have both.
Oh, sorry. It's hard to separate them.
Anyway, that one didn't work out.
No, that one didn't. But I have, you know, there's somebody who thinks, you know, the naked ape, that Desmond Morris.
Why are we on
something.
The subject of naked?
We don't have feathers. So we don't have fur. And so it all went to our minds. You see,
oh,
not our
it?
Eggs.
Okay.
It went to our right. minds. He just didn't understand about the chickens. All right, I want to talk about moral fiction. What's the difference between storytelling with a purpose or witnessing and preaching? How do you know when you're doing one
or the other?
Or the other.
Well, no, I think you kind of don't. And I think that's a decision that the reader makes when the reader is reading you, so that one person's moral storytelling, in which it's integral to the plot and characters, is another person's boring preaching, depending on where they, how they come at it. But what carries, for instance, the Pilgrim's Progress, what carries it? Why was it so extremely popular for so very long?
But the language carries it.
And also the plot. The plot.
Yeah, it's a good plot.
It's an ordeal plot. You've got one ordeal after another, and finally the hero triumphs after everybody else has bit the dust. It's one of those.
Yeah. But it's also in that gorgeous English.
Yeah, and also it was a moment of stylistic transformation. Let's just say it prefigured Hemingway. How's that? Isn't that pretty good?
Yeah, John Bunyan prefiguring Hemingway. Okay.
I've never actually
read
that. Are
they going to talk about that on Twitter?
You can say that. maybe John Bunyan prefigures Hemingway. How about that? I throw it out there. Anybody who wants to write their thesis on that, it's yours.
On Tuesday, I don't know if you saw this because I know you've been flying about busily. David Brooks in the New York Times talked about Jonathan Franzen's latest novel. And did you see that article?
No.
It was very interesting because he talked about the literary orthodoxy of the contemporary realistic novel, basically being about well-off people in the East Coast suburbs, in dysfunctional families, feeling sorry for themselves. And, I mean, can you not name about 20 to 30 novels right off the bat that fit that description?
So are there any novels about well-off West Coast people who feel sorry for themselves?
A few. But
no.
They don't sell as well in the East, which is where the public is off. There may be a few Canadian novels.
We don't do well-off people much.
No, I know.
We don't do them very much at all, but Robertson Davies did them, but they usually ended up committing suicide.
Yeah, they actually had a little juice to them. But, if we're talking about the writer sort of bearing witness, I think what David Brooks was trying to say is that the Franzen type of novel leaves so much unwitnessed. They're so narrow. Realism has narrowed in, which is what I'm getting.
I'm not going to beat up Jonathan Franzen.
No. But I'm going to beat up realism.
Everybody else seems to be beating him up. I'm not entirely sure why, but
it's kind of boring.
Realism. Okay, so
yeah, realism. Yeah.
So there is an ancestry to those kinds of novels, and mm-hmm. and who are those writers? Because I know I read them.
Well, Jane Austen writes about well-off people.
Moderately well-off.
Some of the Bennett family is fairly dysfunctional in some ways.
Yeah, it's also not that well-off.
But they're not feeling sorry for themselves. They're not really that well-off. There's a whole difference of
levels of richness. Maybe this is what happened to Shakespeare's historical dramas in the 21st century.
No.
No, because they don't.
No, I can't bear that thought.
Because they don't murder each other.
No, and they're so joyless. They're so kind of aimless.
Are you making a comment about the East Coast here?
No. I'm thinking about that kind of novel.
Okay.
The great American novel for the last 40 years has basically been sort of this. Over and over, these people who are basically aimless and they don't work at anything, their ambitions are kind of petty.
Where did they get their money?
Because it's easy to make money.
But they must be making it at something.
But the novel doesn't talk about it very much. It's kind of like Henry James. You know, we don't talk about that.
I went back and read a book that I'd never actually read before, and it's called Revolutionary Road. Remember it?
I dimly remember the title.
Yeah, he works in an ad agency. He has been wishing to run off and write a masterpiece
People
in Paris.
People do work at ad agencies in this type of novel. That's true.
Maybe that's the thing. Maybe it's the ad agency that is the joyless. There's now this television thing called Mad Men, which seems to be very popular. And any series made about a period that you happen to have been alive in always feels a little strange to you because it's the clothing, but it's almost too much the clothing, like they kind of overdo the clothing. And I feel the same way about movies made in the 50s with teenagers in them, because I was one then, and they have the felt skirts with the telephones applique onto them, and they have the white bucks and the socks, and they do rock and roll. And when you see a movie like that, you think, well, that's kind of it.
Yeah.
It's like a ghostly recreation of it. It's like a strange, too much echo. You know, there's too many felt skirts with telephones on them. There's a lot. Well, you have to get the clothes right, but then there should be something else.
It's like a lot of the Jane Austen movies. They're all clothes. Yeah, they get the clothes marvelous, and they were such pretty clothes. They wore them.
Well, some of it's dancing.
All right,
but
now.
We have unfortunately now put into everybody's head the idea that Mr. Darcy comes out of a lake in his. It's not true in the book.
It's not true.
What we call now an enhanced book.
Mr. Darcy, oh man, I was so in love with him at 12. Now,
when did you fall in love with Heathcliff, or did that ever happen to you?
I did, but Darcy is deeper in my heart.
Well,
he came first and
he's
foremost.
A definitely more hopeful figure. But
he gives a very bad impression
of real life, which is that you will meet a rude man who is quite mean to you, and then underneath he will turn out to be sensitive and very rich. And,
I don't know about the sensitive. Heathcliff is not very sensitive.
Oh, he
He's
turns
passionate.
Out to be very
sensitive.
No, but he turns out to be very sensitive.
Heathcliff?
Oh, no, I'm talking about Darcy.
Oh, Darcy, oh!
No. Not Heathcliff, no. He's not sensitive.
He hangs a dog.
We can't be going on with that.
You're listening to Margaret Atwood and Ursula Le Guin. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project, and more from Atwood and Le Guin is coming up. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. This time, it's Margaret Atwood and Ursula Le Guin. Let's get back to their conversation from 2010 at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland.
All right, now I want to ask one more big question here. While we're sort of circling around, we're just circling here and there in a way. This is actually a question that I'm going to mangle that I asked Molly Gloss. What would you ask Margaret? And this is a very mangled version of Molly's question, but it is one that I wanted to ask too, because I just wanted to sort of, well, partly I'm edging over towards the science fiction thing, but Molly said she wondered if it had become easier to raise big political, social, moral questions these days in a not entirely realistic fiction. Because realism tries to reflect reality, whatever reality is, directly. And yet, since about 1900, we are told to write it slant and be ironic, be indirect, you know, not be literal. Is it?
Yes.
Has it become harder for realism to bear witness?
Yes.
Yes.
In some areas, yes, and in other areas, no. For instance, there is a lot of fiction coming out of horrible war zones and areas of conflict and ghastly human rights catastrophes. Mm-hmm. And those are what you would call witness-bearing things. If, however, you're trying to reflect that kind of reality, which is, you could take a map of the globe and stick the flags in where that's happening. If you want to, say, talk about Burma in one of these dysfunctional East Coast wealthy families, all it can be, unless one of the kids goes off to try to do work in one of those places, all it can be is a conversation or somebody reading the paper or watching TV. So, yes, it's like the characters in Jane Austen that in passing mention the slave trade. Yeah. They're not actually in the slave trade, but they know about it, kind of. They've heard of it, they have thoughts about it.
That's probably how Heathcliff made his money, you know.
Well, he made it in some quite dodgy way. We know that. We're not sure how he made
it. Slaves, but never mind.
Now, why do you think that?
But now, so,
there's lots of other dodgy ways that he could have made it.
Okay, so has it?
He's a card sharp for one thing.
Has it become? Are we being drawn partly into science fiction or speculative fiction or whatever you want to call it, into sort of not directly realistic fiction, because we can talk seriously there?
Okay. Did you know Judy Merrill at all? Judith Merrill?
Yeah.
So did I. She moved to Toronto. Mm-hmm. And she said the reasons that she... Yeah, wow. Tough lady. She said that one of the reasons she and her generation did it was that it was McCarthyism.
That's why they went into...
Science fiction. Science fiction. Yeah. That they could, that they could discuss social... paradigms.
That's certainly
there.
What the function of science fiction in Russia at that point was.
Absolutely, no question.
Yeah.
You could discuss things in it. And similarly,
But isn't that true now?
We'll get to that in a minute. The Poles during the war would put on these plays that were about squares and triangles. True. So that they would put on symbolic dramas that, in effect, the German occupiers couldn't understand, but that all the Polish people knew what they were talking about. And Kapuscinski, Ryszard Kapuscinski, wrote this book called The Emperor, which was about Haile Selassie. It was about a corrupt political court falling apart. And he could do that because... Officially, that was the right kind of thing to say under that system, but everybody who read it knew it was really about the government in Poland. So there are these things that have always gone on, and the more censorship you have, the more it goes on, or the more trouble you might get into for writing directly about mm-hmm. something, the more you're going to displace it into an historical period, onto another planet, mm-hmm. Into another set of people. I was just reading about the censorship in the days of Shakespeare and what you could and could not represent. And in fact, I was reading a book on Shakespeare by that very same Northrop Frye, who was just mentioned. Mm-hmm. And he says some people have suggested that Titania in Midsummer Night's Dream is a tribute to Queen Elizabeth. He said, I very much doubt it. You know, if anybody had thought that Shakespeare was writing about the Queen Elizabeth having sex with a donkey, their head would have their head would not long have been on their body. So there are these pressures and considerations, and the more pressures there are, the more it's likely, the more you're likely to write about another realm.
That way,
you and me are not so much.
So why do we write?
Because
why do you write the Year of the Flood?
Because it's fun.
No, there's more to it than that.
Yeah, okay. If it weren't fun, I wouldn't do it, and neither
right.
would you.
I agree.
So it is an odd kind of fun. It's true, I confess, and I had another friend whose little niece used to say that she'd been out putting salt on slugs in the garden and called it horrible fun. So I think it is horrible fun. I mean,
But you are not going to confess that you had any serious purpose in writing the
Oh, yes, I'll get to that, too. A serious purpose is always part of horrible fun. That's why the fun is horrible.
That's why you salt the slugs.
Yes. The serious purpose is to get rid of the slugs. Mm-hmm. The horrible fun part is
the
fizzy, gooey thing that happens.
Yes.
Yes, anyway, we cannot discount that. So the serious purpose is the same as the serious purpose in books like that, such as 1984 or Brave New World, which is to take where we are and project it down that mm-hmm. path, mm-hmm. which is not an inevitable path because you can't really predict the future and
there
it may
no
go somewhere else.
Path. Yeah.
It may go somewhere else entirely. But just to take that path and make it more the way it is, and see how we might like that, whether we might like it. Now, inevitably, some people do like it in a future such as that, because conditions, unless they're very, very bad indeed, the word for catastrophe is the same word as the word for opportunity in Chinese, and some people will manage to live well and prosper under those conditions. So you have to take that into account as well. Who's benefiting? Who would benefit from such an arrangement? And who would not benefit? Who would end up on the top? Who would end up on the bottom if things were somewhat changed? And would it be better or worse for most people or not? That wasn't quite right.
But still, that's just sort of looking to see what happens and sort of what if.
It's a blueprint kind of thing.
But
okay, here's a possible house. Do you want to live in it?
You are not going to deny to me that in the Year of the Flood there is some moral urgency.
But that's what those roads are. They are, do we want to go here?
Yeah.
Because here's where we're going,
yeah.
I think. Not that we can really predict the future, but it looks as if we're going in this direction.
We can only guess.
We can only guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it looks as if the glaciers are melting. That's what seems to be happening right now. Will that cause a new ice age, as some people say, or will it cause all kinds of other things that we won't like either?
Yes. I think, yes, it will.
Yeah.
We may like some of them and we may not like others. Yeah, I mean...
And how far will it go, or will it suddenly reverse itself, and will the increased evaporation lead to more snowfall and all the rest of it?
Yeah.
So we actually don't know the answers to those things, but we can make some sort of guessy-wessy. And I was sitting beside one of these guys on the plane, and he said, actually, you don't even need to measure air temperature at all, because he's an expert in this field. You measure the heights of the waves. Why is that? Because as air warms, winds increase. And as winds increase, waves get higher, and waves are now double the height that they were in 40 years ago, or whatever he said, which I forget.
And so we have tornadoes in New York City.
Yeah, but you don't even need to. And you certainly, he said, all that snow falling on Washington, he said, people then say, oh, ha, ha, what global warming? And he said, well, that was predicted, and here's why. And then he told me why, which, of course, I haven't remembered. But
yeah, well, of course, the global warming is such a mistaken phrase. What it is, climate change. Instability of climate.
Yeah, but it is caused by warming.
The overall thing is a warming, but what we experience is instability.
Yeah, what you experience is bumpy.
Yeah.
All the bumps.
Things get bumpier.
Yeah.
Well,
so that's why in the year of the flood we have a semi-tropical situation in and around Boston.
Yeah.
A place where I always love to set my novels.
So that is Boston.
Well, the area. For this one, I had to look for Oryx and Crake and Year of the Flood. I had to look at some place that was fairly flat in relation to the sea.
Uh-huh. I was not sure in either book. I mean, the Handmaid's Tale, as I recall, is fairly clearly...
It's Cambridge.
Cambridge, yeah.
Yes, Harvard.
Where I went to college.
Harvard was so mad at me for a while.
Too bad.
They didn't like those bodies hanging on the wall.
Poor Harvard.
Poor taste. Well, yes, I'm afraid it was. But you can identify every building, and it is true, because I went there in the early 60s. Mm-hmm. One of my co-students said, hasn't anybody realized yet that this book is about the Harvard English Department?
I thought it was perfectly clear. I was there about 12 years before you.
Yeah, so you know that you couldn't get into the Lamont Library.
I didn't go to English. I kept out of the English department. I knew better already.
Yeah, well, it was a great English department, but it was all male.
Ooh. Well, of course, everything was male when I went there.
Well, it was good for your orals, Ursula, because they knew they weren't going to hire you. So they're actually much easier on the women's students.
Oh, because they didn't have to take them seriously.
No. Yeah. And the joke was... It's a joke, Twitter folk. We didn't really do this. The joke was that you could stuff a pillow up under your dress and look pregnant, and you'd be in and out of that orals in 5 minutes flat.
They were frightened. They were very frightened. I bet it was true.
But it's all different now.
All right. Now, three. And the one's about Omelas. But before we go into that question, and this may be the same question as where do the ones that walk away from Omelas go, I want to know, and this is absolutely personal, stupid question, but the people we hear singing at the very end of the Year of the Flood, where are they coming from and going to?
Well, they are the Krakers who we have visited just before that time, and they do have this strange way of singing. And they're coming to help their friend Jimmy because they know he's gone off with a wounded foot.
Oh.
Oh.
That clear and simple. All right. Is there going to be a third one, a third book?
Yes.
Oh, good.
The second one ends just a little bit later than the first one did. And the first one, the reader was given the choice, would you or would you not blow away the last remaining vestiges of the human race?
Mm-hmm. You expect me to answer?
Yes. Yes, anyway, so we find out the answer to that in the second one, and then in the third one. I can't really tell you because I haven't got there yet.
Fair enough. Is this the time to bring up the hat?
The hat. This is the, oh yes, the hat. Yes, let's bring up the hat. This hat, as you'll observe, is made of cardboard brim, a dampened and twisted, then woven newspaper crown with a little bit of string interfacing, some little duct tape accents on the side, and the sewing is a plastic bag, and so is the little bow on the back.
I put it on. Really, it's very charming.
So this is from the Kingston, Ontario production of the Year of the Flood book launch event, in which the entire singing group made their own costumes in this way, including the shoes, which were made out of cardboard, duct tape, and string. And they did the full shout-out, and this was for these launch events that we were doing, and they were partly dramatic. That is, there were three voices reading the three people in the novel, Adam One, Toby, and Wren. There was a singing group who did six hymns from the book, and there was a narrator who was always me. And I strung it together. Of course, we didn't tell the whole story because it was a launch, and you never should tell the whole story. So we did this in the following way. Whoever put on one of these things was given the script and the music and told that they could do it any way they wanted to.
Oh.
So it was up to them how they staged it, how many singers they had. Vancouver just had three very wonderful professional women singers who did a kind of Andrews Sisters close harmony thing. They were terrific with a cello and a flute, as I recall. And some of them, I think Bristol, England, had about 25 people, mixed choir. They raised the roof. They called themselves the Barefoot Singers and did their own musical arrangement. So every place I went, I would turn up without knowing what they were going to do. And we would have maybe an hour and a half rehearsal in the afternoon, and then we would just go on. So I was both the narrator and the audience, because I never knew what was going to happen. And some of them were just fantastic, and then there were a couple of iffy moments.
It's a lot more fun than most book tours, I think.
Well, the beauty of it was that I didn't have to use my voice the whole time.
Yeah.
So it didn't get all worn out, because it does otherwise. You lose your voice. If you were doing seven countries, 19 of these kinds of events, and then a whole bunch of other events of a more conventional
something
kind.
Something to do with the immune system, I think.
Yeah, you wear off the inside. Yeah. I think this is not true, but
it feels like you've worn off
Atwood
something.
Atwood is wrong about throat wearing off. It feels as if...
Margaret, they're not here.
They are. They're everywhere.
They're out there in cyberspace, and let them
Atwood's
stay
medicine.
There.
Atwood's medical theory sucks.
They're getting to you.
Yes, they are. Well, of course, you're not on Twitter. You're a smarter.
You you wouldn't sing us a verse of a hymn, would you?
You want me to sing? Okay, I will sing the one song out of this book that I know how to sing.
You said there was one.
Yes, there is one. And I have to say that when I wrote the book, I did not envisage it having music. I just wrote these things to standard hymn songs, and this one would go very nicely to God Sees the Little Sparrow Fall. And it is a children's hymn because it's for the Festival of Underground Life, and it's about moles and things. And underground life is quite small. We are dependent on it. All the scientific information you will hear in the song is true, I hasten to add. And if you don't know what a nematode is...
I know what a nematode is.
Tell them.
Little wiggly.
Is that all you know?
Well, I watch them through a microscope. They're charming.
Their biomass is larger than ours.
Yes.
You knew that?
True of bacteria, too.
Yes. We're just a kind of blip on the surface.
Yeah. And you look at a forest, and like 9/10 of the forest is underground.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
The festival of underground life. We praise the tiny perfect moles that garden underground. Boom, boom. The ant, the worm, the nematode, wherever they are found. Boom, boom. You're going to ruin me. They live their whole lives in the dark, unseen by human sight. The earth is like the air to them, their day is like our night. They turn the soil and till it, they make the plants to thrive. The earth would be a desert if they were not alive. Boom, 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 boom. The little carrion beetles that seek unlikely places return our husks to elements and tidy up our spaces. And so for God's small creatures beneath the field and wood, let us today give joyful thanks, for God has found them good. Let us today give joyful thanks, for God has found them
good. All right.
But some of the songs are a lot peppier than that. Oh, I think one of
my... That's very nice, though.
That's a kind of lyrical one, but there's the Predator Day song is, I think, pretty peppy. And so is the one for St. Ewell Gibbons Day, which is called The Holy Weeds.
The Holy Weeds.
It's very instructive. It's about what you can eat off your front lawn if push comes to shove.
It's the kind of poetry you need to memorize.
Yeah. I would recommend it.
Yeah. So, is the human race doomed? that was number four.
Is it doomed? I think it's going to hit a bumpy patch. And here is why. The scientists have a little parable, and it goes like this. You have a test tube, and into the test tube you put an amoeba. And the test tube is full of amoeba food. The amoeba splits in two every minute. And at 12 midnight, and you start at 12 noon, and at 12 midnight, the test tube is full of amoebas and there's no more amoeba food left. When is the test tube half full? The answer is not 6 o'clock.
No.
The answer is 1 minute to midnight.
Yeah.
So at 1 minute to midnight, the amoebas are all saying, everything's fine, we still have half a test tube full of amoeba food. And then they split in two again, and that's it. So, your choice. People say to me, well, how do you see things working out in, say, 30 years? And I say, that's not my problem. it's your problem, unless you're my age.
You should be my age.
Yeah, well, then it's not going to be your problem either.
No. And yet,
and then the younger generation goes like this
and grandchildren
and
they
say, don't say that. Yes, it is a problem.
Yeah.
And the fact is, the amoebas cannot multiply indefinitely unless somebody thinks of another source of amoeba food and more space in the test tube. It's just math.
Or just cut down the multiplication, which of course some of us have been saying for the last 50 years.
Well, or they hit a bumpy spot, and what happens then is what happens to any overpopulation of any species. A lot of them get sick and they die and they crash. So I would say not inevitably doomed, because we're smart. We should be able to figure some things out. But bumpy patch for sure. And it's not me making it up. It's just math.
No. Science fiction has been telling us this really for 50 or 60 years, because the scientists have been telling us this for 50 or 60 years. We just didn't want to listen.
Science fiction, big banner, sub-texts, science fiction proper over here, speculative fiction here, granddaddy Jules Verne, science fiction granddaddy H.G. Wells, fantasy, different thing, really.
Totally different.
Folktale, Tennyson, Idylls of the King, wizards,
Science fiction is realistic because what could happen in science fiction could happen. Fantasy is where what can't happen happens.
Like magic.
Yeah, and science fiction and fantasy are not related. Realism and science fiction are related. And fantasy's
fantasy.
Old grandmama that just keeps going.
Yeah, there's a lot of hybrids, though.
Oh, of course.
Hybrids,
thank
hybrids.
Thank goodness.
That was Margaret Atwood and Ursula K. Le Guin speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in 2010. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any other talk in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Spencer Raymond produces the Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community, without whom this show would not be possible. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.